The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mark Newman from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I will share with you information from various medical sources. First, the People's Pharmacy. Do statins cause erectile dysfunction? Question. I am 43. My cholesterol was elevated at 290, so my doctor prescribed atorvastatin. My wife is 39. I have normal sexual urges, but when we have the chance to make love, getting an erection is super difficult. She thinks I'm losing interest in her or that there is someone else. Neither has happened in our 20 years together, and certainly isn't true now. So my erectile difficulties are causing problems in our marriage. I recently had my cholesterol checked again, and it has dropped all the way to 111. I plan to stop taking this drug and maintain the lower levels by eating better. Would that restore my ability to get an erection? The answer? The effects of statins on libido and sexual performance have been controversial for years. There is evidence that these drugs lower testosterone levels, and that's in the BMC Medicine, February 28, 2013. Although the testosterone is linked to sexual desire and performance, a recent meta-analysis involving nearly 70,000 men did not find an association between statin use and erectile dysfunction. And that's cited in the American Journal of Medicine, April 2018. We have heard from many other men who, like you, believe that statins contributed to their sexual problems. We cannot say whether stopping atorvastatin will make a difference, but a healthful diet and exercise to lower cholesterol also may have benefits in the bedroom. Question. I want to know if there is anything I can take for arthritis pain that will not give me stomach ulcers, raise my blood pressure, or lead to a heart attack. I used to take ibuprofen, then naproxen, but they resulted in ulcers. Mobic didn't work, Vioxx helped, but they took it off the market. I am now on diclofenac and take Nexium 40 milligrams for GERD, which is gastroesophageal reflux disease. Could the diclofenac be damaging my stomach? The answer. Diclofenac can be irritating to the digestive tract. It can also increase the risk for hypertension and heart attacks, and that's cited in Pharmacoepidemiology and Drug Safety, June 2013. One prescription option that often is overlooked is the drug salicylate. It is related to aspirin, but is less likely to cause stomach irritation. Salicylate may not reduce the chance of cardiovascular problems, but it doesn't seem to increase the risk either. Cited in the Journal of American Medical Association Cardiology, July 1, 2016. In addition, salicylate improves blood sugar control, cited in Diabetes, Obesity, and Metabolism, October 2017. You can learn more from Graydon's Guide to Alternatives for Arthritis at peoplespharmacy.com. Risk of lethal quinine reaction runs in families. Warning bells went off for me when I read your column about taking quinine for leg cramps. In 1983, my father was given quinidine for a heart arrhythmia. He started bleeding internally as a result of the drug. The bleeding was irreversible, and he died shortly afterward. I discussed it with my internist, and his first question to me was, "Do you drink any mixed drinks with tonic water?" I do not. I have reminded my children about a possible reaction to quinine. The answer, you are very wise to be wary of quinine in tonic or medicines. Some people are genetically predisposed to severe adverse reactions to the heart drug quinidine and its close cousin quinine. Many years ago, a reader shared this frightening experience. One evening, I drank 5 ounces of tonic water. The next morning, I was in the emergency room with a frightening skin reaction. I was hospitalized for many days. My platelet count dropped from 1,000. Now it has gradually come back up to 266,000. I was diagnosed with idiopathic thrombocytopenic purpura triggered by the quinine in the water. It nearly killed me. The Food and Drug Administration banned the use of quinine to treat muscle cramps because it can cause a life-threatening blood disorder. The agency allows quinine in tonic water, however. People who are susceptible to dangerous reactions must avoid this beverage. Question. I am curious to know about the health benefits of hibiscus tea. I've heard that it's good for blood pressure. If so, how do you make it and how much do you drink? Answer. Hibiscus is a bush with lovely bright red flowers. The dried petals can be used to make a pleasantly tart tasting tea. This tea has been used in folk medicine to treat a variety of problems, and scientists have confirmed that it lowers blood pressure as well as cholesterol. Cited in the Journal of Clinical Pharmacology and Therapeutics, December 2017, and Indian Journal of Pharmacology, September to October 2015. From the Associated Press, study reveals bath time toys' dirty secret. Bern, Switzerland. Scientists now have the dirt on the rubber ducky. Those cute yellow bath time toys are, as some parents have long suspected, a haven for nasty bugs. Swiss and American researchers counted the microbes swimming inside the toys and say the murky liquid released when ducks were squeezed contained potentially pathogenic bacteria in 4 out of the 5 toys studied. The bacteria found included Legionella and Pseudomonas aeruginosa, a bacterium that is often implicated in hospital-acquired infections, the author said in a statement. The study by the Swiss Federal Institute of Aquatic Science and Technology, ETH Zurich, and the University of Illinois was published recently in the journal Biofilms and Microbiomes. They turned up a strikingly high volume, up to 75 million cells per 0.15 square inch, and variety of bacteria and fungus in the ducts. Tap water doesn't usually foster the growth of bacteria, the scientists said, but low-quality polymers in the plastic materials give them the nutrients they need. Bodily fluids like urine and sweat, as well as contaminants, and even soap and bathwater add microbes and nutrients like nitrogen and phosphorus and create balmy brine for bacteria. Climbing stairs is a good start on saving your life. From Durham, North Carolina. People who are concerned about the amount of exercise they get can take heart. Short bursts of exercise done throughout the day can provide similar benefits to blocking out time at the gym, according to a new Duke University School of Medicine study. A variety of exercises, even when done in short bursts throughout the day, could help reduce Americans' risk of disease and death, according to research appearing in the Journal of the American Heart Association. For about 30 years, guidelines have suggested that moderate to rigorous activity could provide health benefits, but only if you sustain the activity for 10 minutes or more, said study author William E. Krause of the Duke University School of Medicine. That flies in the face of public health recommendations, like taking the stairs instead of the elevator and parking further from your destination. Those don't take 10 minutes, so why were they recommended? The study is not the first to examine effects related to length of exercise, but it is the first to address hard outcomes, death or real health events like heart attack, Krause said. Krause said he recently served on the Physical Activity Guidelines Advisory Committee, developing the report that will be used by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services to update exercise guidelines. Current guidelines issued in 2008 by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services recommend at least 150 minutes of moderate exercise or 75 minutes of vigorous exercise per week, ideally spread over several days. Updates are due later this year. Krause's study found that even brief trips up and down stairs would count toward accumulated exercise minutes as long as the intensity reaches a moderate or vigorous level of exertion. Moderate exercise was defined as brisk walking at a pace that makes it hard to carry on a conversation. Boosting that pace to a jog would be vigorous exercise for most people, he said. The study findings are good news for most Americans, Kraus said, because they typically get their moderate or vigorous exercise in short bouts, and accumulating 30 minutes per day may be more convenient than setting a half-hour block. For the study, Kraus and investigators from the National Cancer Institute analyzed data from 4,840 people 40 years and older who participated in the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey between 2003 and 2006. The most dramatic improvements in the overall risk for death and disease can occur with a relatively small amount of effort, and the more you do, the better the benefits, Kraus said. In the study, people who got less than 20 minutes of moderate or vigorous activity each day had the highest risk of death. Those who got 60 minutes per day cut their risk of death by more than half, 57%. Getting at least 100 minutes of moderate or vigorous activity per day cut risk of death by 76%, the data showed. In addition to Kraus, study authors include Pedro F. St. Maurice, Richard P. Troiano, and Charles E. Matthews of the National Cancer Institute. My recommendation is for people to continue to do the things we have always suggested, to incorporate activity throughout the day, Kraus stated in his email. Set a goal to move every hour, take your stairs, park further away from your office, and get in a quick walk. I have hopes that when the revised guidelines appear, these latter activities will now count toward the goal of achieving 150 to 300 minutes of moderate to vigorous physical activity per week. From the Mayo Clinic Health Letter, Lung Cancer, a look at risks and prevention. You know, all those years of smoking weren't good for your health, and even though you quit a long time ago, the years that you worked in an office where people routinely lit up only increases your concern. You wonder if it's too late to do something that might reduce your risk of lung cancer. Even if you have never had significant smoke exposure, there are steps you can take to protect your lungs. Read on to learn about the lung cancer risks and prevention strategies. Risk factors. Lung cancer accounts for 1 in 4 cancer-related deaths. Smoking is by far the greatest risk factor for lung cancer, contributing to 85% of lung cancer deaths in the United States. Your risk increases with the number of cigarettes, pipes, or cigars you smoked each day, and the number of years you smoked. But even if you've never smoked, or you quit a long time ago, you may still be at risk. Other factors that increase your risk of lung cancer include exposure to secondhand smoke. Even if you don't smoke, your risk of lung cancer increases if you're exposed to smoke from others. Exposure to radon gas. Radon is produced by the natural breakdown of uranium in soil, rock, and water. Unsafe levels of radon can accumulate in buildings, including some homes. Exposure to asbestos and other carcinogens. Workplace exposure to asbestos and other substances known to cause cancer, including arsenic, chromium, and nickel, can increase your risk of lung cancer. And a family history of lung cancer. If you have a parent, sibling, or child who has had lung cancer, your own risk of the disease is increased. Signs and symptoms. In its early stages, lung cancer typically doesn't cause any signs or symptoms. Any warning signs generally occur when the cancer is more advanced. These include persistent cough, mucus coughed up from the lungs, sputum that's streaked with blood, chest pain, voice changes, progressively worsening shortness of breath, and recurrent pneumonia or bronchitis. If you're concerned about lung cancer, your doctor can order tests to look for the cancer. After performing a physical exam and history, your doctor may recommend imaging tests. X-ray imaging may be used to evaluate symptoms. A CT scan can detect abnormalities. Sputum cytology. If your cough is producing sputum, viewing the sputum under a microscope can sometimes reveal the presence of cancerous cells. Biopsy. If a suspicious nodule or a mass is found, a sample of cells may be removed to look for any abnormalities. and bronchoscopy. A scope is placed into the airways to evaluate coughing up blood and is the most frequent method of getting a biopsy if imaging reveals an abnormality. Treatment. If lung cancer is detected, you and your doctor will work together to choose a treatment plan that's best for you, taking into consideration your overall health, the extent of the cancer, and your personal preferences. Options traditionally include surgery, radiation, chemotherapy, or a combination of chemotherapy and radiation. In addition, newer treatments include targeted drug therapies that work by exploiting specific abnormalities or mutations in cancer cells. In many cases, more than one treatment method will be the best approach. While treatments continue to improve, lung cancer remains a very deadly disease. 5-year survival rates are only 15% for men and 21% for women. This is largely because the disease usually goes undetected before manifesting at an advanced, less treatable stage. Prevention? Can lung cancer be avoided? No, not always. But there are steps you can take to reduce your risk. Don't smoke. If you've never smoked, don't start. If you do, quitting will be the number one thing you do to improve your health. Whether you're an occasional or heavy smoker, quitting reduces your risk of lung cancer along with heart disease, stroke, and a number of other significant health concerns. Talk to your doctor about using stop smoking aids and other strategies for quitting that can help you along the way. Options include nicotine replacement products, medications, and support groups. Avoid secondhand smoke. If you live with, work, or spend time with someone who smokes, urge the person to quit or to smoke away from you and others. Whenever possible, avoid areas where people smoke. Test your home for radon. Have the radon levels in your home checked, especially if you live in a region where it's a known problem. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency has a number of resources available on its website about radon and radon testing. View www.epa.gov/radon for more information. Protect yourself from carcinogens. Take precautions to protect yourself from exposure to toxic chemicals. For example, wear a mask while using cleaning products in the home or when working with chemicals such as in the workshop. And follow a healthy lifestyle. Although it's not clear if they decrease the risk of lung cancer, some evidence has shown that diet and exercise may have an impact. Eat a diet full of a variety of fruits and vegetables and try to exercise most days of the week. Should you be screened? Have you been screened for lung cancer? If not, you're not alone. A recent report showed that less than 4% of people deemed at high risk of lung cancer underwent the recommended screening test. For the average healthy person, routine screening for lung cancer isn't necessary or appropriate. However, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force recommends an annual low-dose computerized tomography, or CT, scan for people at high risk. You're considered high risk if you're between the ages of 55 and 80 and you have a 30-pack year history of smoking. This could mean smoking one pack a day for 30 years or two packs a day for 15 years or three packs a day for 10 years. Either currently smoke or quit smoking within the past 15 years. You may also be at high risk if you have a similar smoking history, yet quit more than 15 years ago, or have chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, or a family member, parent, or sibling who had lung cancer. A study has shown that lung cancer screening saves lives by finding cancer early or earlier when it may be treated more successfully. However, lung cancer screening often reveals benign conditions such as nodules that may require invasive testing and expose people to unnecessary risks and worry. Talk with your doctor about the benefits and risks of lung cancer screening. The long-term health benefits of quitting smoking. After 1 year, your risk of coronary heart disease is about half that of a smoker's. After 5 years, your stroke risk is reduced to that of a non-smoker 5 to 15 years after quitting. 10 years, your risk of lung cancer falls to about half that of a smoker, and your risk of cancer of the mouth, throat, esophagus, bladder, cervix, and pancreas decreases. And after 15 years, the risk of coronary heart disease is that of a non-smoker. Health tips: removing an object from the eye. If grit gets in your eye, don't rub it. Your eye may be able to flush out a small item such as an eyelash or sand with blinking and tearing. If you're wearing contact lenses when this happens, you may need to remove it. If that's not enough, try flushing the eye using a bottle of artificial tears or with water using an eye cup or small glass. Place the rim of the glass or bottle on the bottom of the base of the eye socket. Slowly tip the glass and let the water run over the eye while keeping it open. If that doesn't work, have someone perform the following steps. Locate the object. After washing your hands, examine the person's eye by gently pulling the lower lid downward while the person looks upward. Reverse this procedure for the upper lid. And then use a light touch for an object on the surface of the eye. You may be able to manually remove the object by holding the eyelid open and using a moistened cotton swab or soft, clean cloth to lightly blot and remove the object, being sure to direct the object away from the pupil. Skip the steps above and seek emergency care, especially if an object is embedded in the eyeball, if the object doesn't move with blinking, if the object is large and makes it difficult to close the eye, or if the person has a lot of pain, sensitivity to light, or decreased vision. To reduce eye movement, cover both eyes with a cloth, or, to avoid disturbing the object, a paper cup. Meningioma, brain tumor that's usually non-cancerous. Your sinus troubles led to an imaging test of your head that turned up some shocking news. You have a brain tumor. Before the news had time to register, your doctor provided some reassurance. Your tumor appears to be a type of brain tumor called a meningioma. These tumors are usually non-cancerous or benign, and if that isn't causing any symptoms, treatment may not even be needed. Silver lining: meningiomas develop from the protective layer of tissues, or the meninges, that line and surround the outer surface of your brain and spinal cord. They account for about 30% of tumors that originate in the brain or spinal cord, and as such, they're the most common type of brain tumor. While about 90% of meningiomas occur above the spinal cord, such as the brain or skull, about 10% occur in the spinal cord. It's not entirely clear what causes meningiomas, but they are about twice as common in women as they are in men, and incidence rises with age. Other factors that may increase risk include genetics, hormonal factors, obesity, and a history of radiation therapy of the head. Meningiomas are classified as the following categories: benign. Most meningiomas are benign, grade 1 tumors that don't grow beyond the meninges and into the brain. Next, atypical. Fewer than 10% are called atypical grade 2 tumors. These usually grow more rapidly than grade 1 tumors and are more likely to return after treatment. Cancerous or malignant. About 2 to 3% of meningiomas are cancerous, meaning they could invade brain tissues and spread to other parts of your body. Many meningiomas cause minimal or no symptoms. These are often grade 1 tumors that grow very slowly over time and either go undiscovered or will be found during imaging for another reason. Meningiomas generally begin to cause problems only when the tumor grows large enough to put pressure on brain tissue. Signs and symptoms of this depend on where the tumor is located, but may include seizures, vision changes such as blurriness, double vision, blind spots, or progressive vision loss in one eye. These changes may not be readily recognized as they can occur gradually and are assumed to be normal vision decline that comes with aging. Loss of hearing or smell, changes in memory, concentration or personality, weakness or numbness in arms and legs, which can lead to issues with balance or walking, and persistent headaches. Action versus waiting. If a meningioma is suspected, magnetic resonance imaging, or an MRI, is among the most useful tools in making a diagnosis and mapping tumor location and size. Other tests may be performed, particularly if the tumor appears to be atypical or cancerous. If a grade 1 meningioma is relatively small and not causing symptoms, holding off on treatment, also called active surveillance, may be the preferred option. Typically, the tumor is reassessed with an MRI every 3 to 6 months, and less frequently after that if the tumor stays in check. If the tumor is growing or starts to cause symptoms, treatment can be initiated. Research has shown that small tumors often stay small and never cause a problem. In comparison, treatment, although reasonably safe, can cause discomfort, complications, or side effects. Complications are more common in older adults. For these reasons, active surveillance is a particularly good option for appropriately selected older adults. When treatment is considered necessary, options include surgery. Larger tumors and tumors that are growing quickly or causing symptoms are often assessed for surgical removal. The feasibility of surgery depends on individual circumstances, such as overall health, and also on the location of the tumor. For example, tumors near the upper part of the skull are generally quite accessible and easier to remove than are tumors in the lower part of the brain. Sometimes the tumor can be completely removed, and this can cure the disease. Other times, only partial removal is possible. In one study of older adults, complications related to surgery occurred in about 9% of cases. Potential complications include seizures, fluid accumulation on the brain, or cerebral edema, or often temporary problems such as weakness, speech problems, or difficulty with coordination. Radiation therapy. This may be used in addition to surgery if the tumor is atypical or cancerous, or if the tumor is only partially removed. It may also be used as the only treatment. Used alone, radiation therapy is partially effective in older adults who have smaller tumors and sensitive locations. A number of radiation techniques may be used with the goal of hitting tumor cells with maximum damaging radiation while sparing healthy cells. One type, stereotactic radiosurgery, involves a single high dose of radiation delivered from multiple angles to a focused spot. Other types involve smaller doses given in multiple sessions over time. Side effects of radiation therapy, such as hair loss, fatigue, or skin redness, are generally mild and vary by radiation delivery method. Recurrence. After treatment has been completed, there is typically a period of monitoring for a regrowth or recurrence. Recurrence rates for most types of meningiomas are low, but they can occur, usually at or near the initial location. Recurrence may be treated with additional surgery or radiation therapy. We've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Mark Newman, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comment or questions, please call 919-832-5138 and stay healthy. Thank you.